Would you like to accelerate your career and reach your full potential in just minutes a day? Welcome to the LeadX Show with New York Times bestselling author and Inc. 500 entrepreneur, Kevin Cruz.
Hello, everyone. Kevin Cruz here. Welcome to the LeadX Show, the smartest way to start your day. And in just a minute, we're going to talk with a young woman who left her consulting job to start her own charity. But I got a question for you. First, have you liked our Facebook page yet? We are LeadX Life, L-I-F-E, on Facebook. You got to go on to Facebook, search for LeadX Life, like the page, and turn on notifications because we're doing a lot of live video training, free career development, free professional development. And with notifications on, you'll be alerted to the fact when we go live with a new training program. Also, you might not know that I actually record the weekly wrap-up show for the podcast as a Facebook Live video. So go on to Facebook, look up LeadX Life, like the page, turn on notifications, and I'll see you there. Today's 1 minute tip is exceed client expectations. Client satisfaction is everything. And remember, you might actually be working for an external customer or client, or your quote unquote client could be another colleague in your company. They're an internal client. Or maybe your client is your boss. Either way, you need to nail client satisfaction. One way to do that, set realistic expectations. Don't set yourself up for failure by agreeing to an impossible deliverable. Don't set yourself up for failure by saying something can be done when you know it's going to take a little extra time. You're better off picking a schedule that you know you can beat. If you ever agree to an aggressive schedule, say, I'm not sure it can be done, but I'll try my hardest and I'll get back to you. A second key when you want to, you know, exceed client expectations, streamline contact. You can't have 5 different people at your customer interacting, you know, with you or with 5 different people on your team. Have a single point of contact at the customer and on your team. Eliminate communication chaos in this way. And then finally, get in front of changes, get in front of problems. Avoid blindsiding your client with cost overruns or delays. Keep your client up to date on project deliverables and timelines before they have to ask, and let them know immediately if there's a change in scope that they're going to have to pay for or accommodate. So those 3 things, realistic schedule, single point of contact, and don't blindside them. That's going to be how you exceed client expectations. Our guest today is on a mission to eradicate poverty, and she believes that giving dignified, steady, fair wage work is the most effective way to do just that. She left a high-paying consulting job at the age of 25 to start a nonprofit called SamaSource. You may have already seen her profiled in the New York Times, Fast Company, Wired, or Forbes. And her new book is Give Work, Reversing Poverty One Job at a Time. Our guest is Lila Jana. Lila, welcome to the show.
It's such a pleasure to be here, Kevin. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's definitely our pleasure, and I want to ask about your book in a minute. But I always start with all of our guests by just asking, think back maybe earlier in your career, and will you share a time when you failed at something? Because we want to know what lesson you learned, so you know we can all learn from that lesson too.
It's hard to pick just one example of failure because there have been so many, Kevin. I will say that, you know, we launched a crowdfunding site for medical treatments. We were actually the first organization to launch an international crowdfunding platform to help women and children fundraise for critical surgeries. So things like birth injuries, which are very common in the developing world. Women can't afford to go to a clinic, and so they have to give birth in a hut somewhere and can get severely injured and infected. And so these types of medical procedures are really poorly funded. And we thought, what if we could create a website where you could go and browse profiles of people who needed help and fund them?
Great idea.
It seems like it'd be a great idea. We set it up in 2012. We actually funded about 16,000 patient treatments.
Wow.
We raised over $1 million, but we realized it was not our core competency at SomaSource. We are known for doing work. That's our philosophy. We had a successful social enterprise training people to do work for big tech companies from the same backgrounds as these women that we were funding surgeries for, but it just really, the alignment wasn't there with our core mission and what people, what the public knew of us to be as an organization. And focus is the most important thing as an entrepreneur. It will kill you if you don't focus. And it's often my Achilles heel because I kind of want to do everything. And so we really struggled and finally made the decision to spin off Sama Hope and merge it with a new division of Johnson & Johnson that they were setting up to try to do the same thing. So it was failure in the sense that we failed to keep the platform alive as an organization. We had to make the difficult decision to merge it with another bigger health platform. I think it was ultimately the right decision, but it was very painful. It was like, I can't imagine what it's like to have a child, but it felt like giving up a baby.
Right, right. Well, I think this theme of focus comes up a lot, especially among entrepreneurs. And of course, entrepreneurs also realize, you know, there's really no win or lose. It's win or learn. And I was just watching, I don't know if you had a chance to see it yet or not, Lila, but the Becoming Warren Buffett, the documentary on Netflix. And apparently Bill Gates's father gave an exercise to both Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and said, write down one word, just one word that is most important, has been the most important key to your success. And completely separately, they both wrote the same one word, which was focus. And I think it's such an important reminder. It's not, in entrepreneurs, it's almost like we have a disease. Like every day I wake up and I've got a new idea for a great company that's going to help everybody and make a lot of money. But when we, you know, we only have so many minutes in a day, 1,440 actually. So we need to stay focused and stay in our brand. And it's great that you're able to find a partner to take over some stewardship for that and invest your energy and everything, you know, into other projects. So let me ask about, you know, your new book, again, is called Give Work. It talks about the challenge with global poverty, potential solutions, and, you know, it addresses these issues through your own journey. So, you know, take us back. What led you to starting SomaSource to begin with?
I had always wanted to be a marine biologist. I loved being in the ocean. I love nature. You know, the underwater is my happy place. And I happened to, before I started college, go and sign up for a volunteer trip in West Africa. I was 17. I was not particularly motivated by saving the world. I wanted more to have an adventure and get out of Southern California where I was living and just see the world. So I signed up for this trip. I managed to get a scholarship from, of all places, a big tobacco company and convince them that I could use this scholarship to do volunteer work. So I go off to Ghana in what should be the second semester of my senior year in high school, thinking I'll have this experience, go to college, and my life will continue on as normal. And I got there and I witnessed what it's like for people to live on less than $2 a day, very up close. I lived in a very small, very poor village, and I was shocked not so much by the poverty, but by the disparity between the poverty and the level of talent of the people that I lived among. Mm. I had students at my school who could name U.S. senators who listened to Voice of America and BBC Radio when they were able to get to electricity,
wow,
who were just so hungry for knowledge and so willing to work that it made no sense to me that these people were so desperately poor that they couldn't afford very basic medical care. There was a kid in our village who died in the 6 months that I was living there because he, unbeknownst to me, contracted malaria, and then his family couldn't afford the $5 malaria medication to save his life. And that kind of avoidable suffering just should not exist in the world in this century. There's absolutely no reason for it. And it's not a problem of resources. We have more than enough resources in the world to ensure that every man, woman, and child enjoys the basic necessities of life. It's really an allocation and a distribution problem. And I became really curious about why poor people are poor and what I could do about it. And it was one of those things where I couldn't really sleep at night if I didn't do something.
Right.
So I got forced into this field. And the thing that profoundly affected me was, again, this disparity between the talent that I saw every day in Ghana and the lack of opportunity and poverty. And I thought to myself, what if I could create some kind of organization that creates jobs for people at this income level? And I'd seen firsthand how devastating the aid and charity model can be for poor people. Poor people don't want our handouts. They don't want our charity. They want the same things that you and I want. They want the chance to earn a decent living, to spend that money that they earn how they feel is necessary to support themselves and their families. And I think there's increasing and overwhelmingly convincing data that the way we address this problem of poverty at the root is by getting cash directly into low-income people's hands. Mm. And I think the most effective way to do that is through giving work rather than through giving handouts.
So you've addressed, like, and this is fascinating how, you know, a very personal experience really changed your own path. And you said you have to spend your time addressing this problem. And you saw that we need to get the cash into their hands. It's not through charity and other projects. So then how did you come up with the idea for SamaSource? I mean, how do you end up providing jobs for people in less developed countries?
So it was really interesting how this worked out. I'd looked at different development models. I'd studied microfinance, which I thought was really promising, this idea of giving loans that they could use to start businesses or to boost existing businesses. But around the time that I was having these ideas, the digital economy was expanding really quickly around the world. And Thomas Friedman had just written The World is Flat. I got a chance to meet him. And it sort of dawned on me that one area that really hadn't been tapped for creating jobs for low-income people was in the internet economy. For the first time in history, we have internet infrastructure rolling out all over the world, including in very low-income places, places like slums, you know, where over a billion people living on less than $2 a day currently live, places like rural areas in Africa and Asia. And for the first time, theoretically, this would allow someone growing up in a slum in Kenya or a rural part of northern Uganda to do work for a company or a person on the other side of the world. And the most exciting aspect of this is that the biggest challenge in poor countries is that even if you can give a low-income person a loan and let's say they can expand their farm stand to sell more tomatoes, they're still only selling to other people who also make less than $2 a day. So the market potential, you know, the consumer base that they're able to sell into is very limited. And that's what keeps poor people locked in poverty. But if you can instead teach them a skill that they can sell to an international market, to much wealthier people and companies, maybe on the other side of the world, all of a sudden you have a mechanism for moving someone out of poverty very quickly. And that was the premise of the internet economy. So I thought to myself, you know, this outsourcing model is taking off in India and Asia, but most of the people getting hired to do, say, call center jobs come from middle-class backgrounds. They're not really low-income people. Right. They're not coming from slums and rural areas. And I thought to myself that I could create a model, maybe by making the units of work smaller and more simple, that would allow someone from a slum, someone from a genuinely poor background to do this work. And that's how SamaSource was born. And our first projects were really doing very simple tasks, things like data entry, that didn't require a ton of training. And so our workers were people who came in with secondary school backgrounds. Maybe they'd finished local high school in, you know, in Nairobi in Kenya. They were able to read and write English, but there were just no jobs for them there. And that's how we got started.
So your initial projects, again, you mentioned, say, so Kenya. So you would have an office, a physical place in Kenya where people could come in, get the training, and also complete the work. I assume you had, you know, internet connection there, and they would be doing work for, was it, you know, tech companies in Silicon Valley or others?
It started off with who I had connections to. I figured the model would be, you know, I would kind of hustle and try to find contracts. And then I had a partner in Kenya who had an internet cafe. So, you know, a place where people could go and use the internet because nobody had internet access or computers at home or even electricity, but people could go in there and use the internet. And then the challenge with these internet cafe models that were springing up all over the developing world is that low-income people couldn't afford to spend a dollar an hour to browse the internet.
Right.
They had no money. And so I figured this was a really interesting business model. I could bring in these contracts and we could use these internet centers that already existed as small data entry shops where we could train local youth to do this work from those computer centers and they could earn money and the internet cafe business model would also work. So that's how we started. The first contract that I won was from a friend who I think took pity on me. He's a nonprofit entrepreneur and he started the largest online library for blind readers called Bookshare.org. And so he was digitizing all these books that publishers gave him for free, converting them from PDF into text files so that the text could be read by an audio software program.
Right.
And the problem he had was that the conversion process resulted in all these errors in the text. So if you were a blind person going on Bookshare.org to listen to an audiobook, you would hear, I don't know, 5% of the words would be totally garbled, which really made the reading experience terrible. So we won the contract to clean up those text files. And the win-win of having this work done by youth from Kenya who were escaping poverty in order to allow blind readers to enjoy good books, it was such a win-win. And the CEO of that organization, Benetech, I think gave me the deal because I seemed so eager. I walked into his office with a brochure I'd made. I'd printed it out at Kinko's and I basically told him, I said, Jim, I will personally do the quality assurance on this contract. I will review every word of every text file that goes through this system to make sure that it's correct. And I did.
Right.
And we had great quality. And that was our first contract. It was for $30,000 and it was in 2008.
That's amazing. So fast forward to, you know, the last 12 months, what type of work are people doing? And is it primarily in Kenya or is it in Ghana? And what type of, you know, companies are funding it from the developed side?
So we actually became profitable as a social enterprise last year, even though we're a nonprofit, a 501c3, which means we're self-sustaining off of the money we earn from these contracts, which just gives us a lot of freedom.
Huge milestone.
Mm-hmm. and we now employ over 1,200 workers in Kenya, Uganda, India, and Haiti. They all come from very low-income backgrounds. On average, they move from under $2.50 a day in income before they start at Samasource, and we increase their income by over 400%.
Wow.
And what's remarkable is that that income stays at that level even 3 years after they leave Samasource because they're able to enter kind of a formal economy and build skills that allow them to stay out of poverty for a lifetime. So it really is an effective way to move someone out of poverty. The contracts that we're doing now are mostly in the machine learning and artificial intelligence space. So we're doing a lot of image tagging and other types of what is called training data creation that is part of the applications for many of these new technologies in Silicon Valley. So for example, self-driving cars are powered by images tagged by Samasource workers. Many of the content websites in Silicon Valley are now, you know, powered by Samasource workers editing or curating that content. A good example would be Glassdoor and TripAdvisor. These are two large websites that use Samasource services to curate content.
That's incredible. And it's great that, you know, on the LeadX show, we're always talking about career development and getting ahead. And sometimes, you know, I sort of purposely scare people and say, you know, the robots are coming, AI is coming, like we all need to up our game. And yet it is true that with any new technology, it also creates, you know, job opportunities for others. And in this case, you know, it's at the lower end by Western standards, but it's an amazing opportunity in the less developed countries. Now, I'm curious, in 2015, you started a company called LuxMe, and it's actually spelled LXMI, and this one is a for-profit company. So tell us about the mission of LuxMe and why you decided to go create it as a for-profit.
Absolutely. So LuxMe is an attempt to build the Samasource model in a new category, in the category of luxury, skincare, and beauty. luxury is a really exciting industry to me because in general, there are much higher margins than in other industries, especially in luxury beauty and skincare, where customers routinely pay hundreds of dollars for, say, a jar of skin cream. And in my view, if you're paying that kind of money for a product that makes you more beautiful, it should also make the world more beautiful. We should also be able to pay living wages in the supply chain, use healthy, organic, plant-based ingredients, not include toxic ingredients. So luxury gives you the benefit as a business model of having the margin to do good and to do so without compromising investor returns. And this is what's so exciting to me is that I think you can actually build a profitable business, raise money from, you know, more traditional investors, and do the kind of good we're doing at SamaSource by lifting people out of poverty because these products can command higher price points. So I was really intrigued by that. And I also think that in some ways, giving back is the new luxury.
Right.
And I think increasingly we're seeing that awareness. We're seeing a number of brands like Tom's that have sort of a do-gooder element to them that are really taking off, especially among millennials. So that was the impetus for creating Luxme. And the story of how it came to be is that I was in northern Uganda. I love, you know, again, as an entrepreneur, we were talking about this earlier. I love getting out there when I'm in Africa and meeting people and just kind of letting those ideas flow. And I was in a local craft market looking at beadwork, which is really beautiful out there. And I came across this incredible ingredient called Nilotica. It is a very rare type of shea butter. It's actually a different subspecies from what most people have seen in commercial products here in the U.S. It only grows wild at the source of the Nile River in northern Uganda, South Sudan, and parts of Ethiopia. It's a truly rare ingredient in that these trees that this nut grows on take 20 years to mature. And I thought to myself, what is more luxurious than something that comes from the wild, from a pristine environment that is, you know, naturally organic because no one can afford to put pesticides or fertilizers on these trees, that is hand collected and hand harvested and cold pressed. So I started using this butter that comes out of the cold pressing process and fell in love with it and thought to myself, this could be the basis for an entirely new brand and company based on this idea of pure wild ingredients that come from the world's most pristine places. And, you know, we can scour the world for these ingredients and bring them to U.S. consumers. And the idea was these ingredients have to work. They have to be highly effective clinically. And they also have to create work for local women who do the harvesting and the supply chain. So it's a give work model for skincare and personal care that appeals to a luxury customer. We launched in October last year in 300 Sephora stores and on QVC. And we're the first fair trade and organic brand sold nationwide at Sephora, I think as a reflection of this trend towards more ethical and sustainable products.
Geez, right out of the gates, you got Sephora. How'd you pull that off?
A lot of convincing. We walk them through our, you know, our premise. I think we also really invested heavily in creating a beautiful brand. I think the other thing about this category is that for a long time, consumers have associated natural or good for you products with ugly packaging and kind of a little bit of a hippie marketing story. And I wanted to package our products so that they looked as good as Chanel products. Mm-hmm. So we really invested in great packaging design. We use glass jars, so they're BPA free. We invested in a great design firm that did a lot of our marketing and branding work. And I think that's what got us the Sephora and the QVC deals.
That's great. And listeners, you know, LeadX family, there's an interesting thing in this story that Lila's told us about SamaSource as a nonprofit and then Luxme as a for-profit. And this is something I struggled with when I started up LeadX last year. You know, we're on a mission to provide world-class free leadership development for everyone around the world. And at first, my instinct is this is a nonprofit. However, it is very difficult to raise money for nonprofits. And as Lila said, she used this phrase, traditional funding sources. If you are a for-profit company, suddenly you can go to the angel investors, the VCs, and others, get traditional capital, and really it doesn't change your mission. It really doesn't change your work as long as you, you know, maintain this new idea of being a socially conscious for-profit company. You're looking for what my friends at the Acumen Fund in New York would call patient capital, you know, people who are willing to invest, knowing that they're going to do well financially, but also do well in terms of making the world a better place. So I'm always interested in that decision, because I'm assuming, Lila, that, I mean, fundraising is one of the harder things to do for SamaSource.
It's really tough. And for, you know, we're now 9 years old. For the first 5 or 6 years, it occupied so much of my time and even my, you know, my mental and emotional energy. And I think the challenge in our industry, you know, on the nonprofit side in general, is that there's this huge disconnect between the way the grant cycles work and how these organizations operate. So, you know, in order to win a big grant, you basically have to write up this big plan and tell the grant maker how you plan to spend the money, you know, 5 years down the line. Right. Literally, like, this is how many pencils we're going to buy in year five of this grant. And then every time you change that, and that's obviously inevitable that that plan is going to change, especially if you're in a dynamic sector like technology in Silicon Valley, then you have to submit grant amendments and kind of, you know, negotiate with the funder to continue funding the program. And this model is just so broken.
Right.
You know, we need to be able to fund this kind of social and environmental work the same way that we fund startups, which is to say, we trust the team, we trust the founder, they seem to have a good business model, we give them the cash. Obviously, we expect reporting on a quarterly or an annual basis on outcomes. But, you know, we need to shift the way that grants and donations work and are so tied to a plan that has to change. And I think it's one of the reasons the industry can be so frustrating and stagnant for dynamic entrepreneurs.
Yeah, very frustrating. So let me, you've been great with your time with us today. You know, really quickly, I'm curious about some broader career things. I mean, you've pivoted, went to Harvard, you went into consulting, still working in this space, but then, you know, launched your new organizations. I mean, in general, if there was a young professional out there who wanted to stand out and get ahead in her career, like, what kind of career advice would you give her?
Sure. Well, the first thing that I learned is that, especially in the social sector, whether you want to start a social enterprise or go and work for a nonprofit, real business skills are in high demand. So if you know how to read a P&L, if you know how to build an Excel financial model, if you know how to grow sales of a company, if you can work on finance or do bookkeeping, these are all real business skills that every organization needs. And a lot of people think if they go into social or environmental work that they need experience, you know, helping people, or, you know, they need experience with the cause. What you need the most experience in is an actual business function. And I think the best way to get that is to go and work, I know I hate to say this, but to go and work for a large company that has a good training program. I think that I basically got a free MBA when I did management consulting, right, and for 2 years was thrust into really difficult business situations that, you know, trial by fire made me learn how to have these skills. And they were invaluable in the early days of SamaSource before I could afford to hire a CFO or a head of sales. I had to do all this myself.
And gives you incredible credibility, whether you're raising money for a nonprofit or looking for investors on your for-profit. The fact that you have those skills from the real world, I mean, is going to just help you no matter what you want to do with it.
Absolutely. And you can still work for a great mission-driven company and build those skills, but it helps to be able to quantify the skills that you have. So whenever I make a hire, I look at what were the results that person achieved in their prior role. And so if they were working for a nonprofit and they were in charge of, say, fundraising or business development, how much additional capital did they actually bring in? How did they manage the pipeline? What training tools did they use? How did they hire good people? So, you know, if you're able to kind of quantitatively build up your skill set so that you can prove that you can move the needle for an organization, that's what makes you hireable. And it also is what makes you a fundable entrepreneur.
That's right. And, you know, another common frustration is, you know, being the boss, being a manager. And, you know, if you could place a phone call back in time, you know, maybe what, 7, 8 years ago to a younger version of yourself as you started to, you know, manage team members and manage people remotely, you know, what would be some leadership advice, something you would have told yourself, you know, the younger version of yourself?
I was just writing this up. I think I kind of overshared in this New York Times interview a couple months ago, but I talked about having had a tough childhood, and we're now learning that many entrepreneurs have had childhood adversity, and that what it builds on the one hand is grit, which is a remarkably important skill for any entrepreneur. But on the other hand, it builds this sense of hypervigilance of, you know, you're always a little bit paranoid that something's going to go wrong. And if you grew up in an environment where there was a lot of stress or abuse or there were these sorts of challenges, you are wired to be a bit paranoid and you're always waiting for the emergency to happen. And while it can be good to be prepared, Andy Grove famously said, right, only the paranoid survive, it is not a healthy environment in which to grow a great team. People in an early stage company need to feel comfortable taking risks. They need to feel trusted. They need to feel camaraderie. And that sort of sense of family and community, I think, is what gets people through the really tough early days in a startup where you can't pay them fairly, you know, where you don't have any good benefits, where you don't have snacks in the lunchroom or any of the perks that a bigger company would have. And it was a tough lesson for me that I could, you know, be hypervigilant maybe in my own head or maybe when I thought long-term about the business, but I couldn't bring that stress to work because it really would alter the dynamics of my team. And over time, I learned that, you know, making decisions from a calm and friendly and warm and kind of open position bonded my teammates to me and made them much more loyal to me as a boss and to the company and our mission than when I was operating from a place of, oh my God, if we don't get the sale, the company's going to go under, and, you know, of constant stress. I think it kind of lowered everyone's cortisol levels. And it's a very helpful reminder because it can be so stressful in the early days of a company. And it's not a skill. You know, we don't really teach meditation to entrepreneurs. Right. We don't teach tools to kind of bring you back to a place of calm groundedness. And to me, that was one of the most important leadership lessons I learned over the last decade.
So last question, give us something really practical today. Cause I'm always telling our listeners, like, let's just get 1% better today. So give us a challenge. What do you want us to do today?
At this time, I think many of us have given up on our federal government to do the kinds of things we need to do to make the world better. A lot of us are deeply concerned about the environment and what's going to happen if we don't push better environmental policy. But we as consumers have tremendous power. Every second that a penny or a dollar leaves our bank account, we are voting with that money on what kind of a world we want to build. So I think the most important thing that we can do as consumers today is to vote with our dollars and choose companies and brands that make the world better. So buy fair trade wherever possible. You know, if you're buying produce at the market, buy organic, support local farmers, and realize that the money that you're spending every day is perhaps the most powerful vote you have in choosing a better world.
Amen. I agree with that. Lila, where can our listeners find out more about, you know, your companies, stay in touch with what you're doing? What are all the links and everything we should know about?
I send out a newsletter once in a while when I have a moment. Listeners can subscribe at lilajanah.com, LEILAJANAH.com. And those handles are also active on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. And then the book, Give Work, has a website dedicated to it where we're building out a movement that will, among other things, share what kinds of companies and brands have this Give Work philosophy, where if you buy from them, you're also supporting poverty reduction. So givework.org is where listeners can find out more about that movement.
We'll put all this information in the show notes, of course. Lila, thank you for all the great work you're doing, and thanks for coming on to the LeadX Show.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Kevin.
Thanks. LeadX family, don't forget, you can get links and notes from this interview over at leadx.org. And you can also download our free ebook, Richard Branson's 7 Secrets to Leadership, at leadx.org/Branson. And if you want to get more LeadX in your everyday life, just follow us at LeadX Life on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. That's one word, LeadX Life. And if you've ever gotten even just one good idea from a LeadX show, do me a huge favor. It takes less than a minute. And just subscribe to the show on iTunes and leave a quick rating. Just go to leadx.org/subscribe. Until next time, friends, remember, leadership is about influence, which means we are all leaders. Whether you're a salesperson or a soldier, an entrepreneur or an executive, a coach or a counselor, you are leading all of the time. You positively influence with your behavior, and you influence negatively when you're a bystander. How will you lead today?